is another of our foundational teachings classes. So really going back to the teachings of the Buddha. So there's plenty of teachings that came after his lifetime, and Zen teachings, and you know, Buddhism just keeps on growing. So that's one of the cool things about our tradition. But going back to the real basics, the fundamentals, which to some extent, like what I'm going to be talking about tonight, isn't something that we really talk about a lot in Zen, at least not this way. It manifests in our practice, but in kind of different forms, which I did a pair of podcast episodes on this a ways back, where I did one on mindfulness, and then the second one was kind of like, you know, what does that have to do with Zen, and how do we practice these things inside of Zen? But I'm always, even though we don't necessarily talk about them, we don't necessarily talk a whole lot about the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path in our everyday discussions of practice. Zen does not deny anything that came before. See, if I think of these as kind of like building blocks down at the base, and we have our own versions of them or practices that are built on them, but they're all, it's compatible all the way back down to the bottom, even if we don't use the same language. So tonight and next week, we'll be talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. So this is a teaching of the Buddha that he repeated many, 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 many times over the course of his, like, whatever it was, like 40 years of teaching, 50 years of teaching. Basically, it's his answer whenever anybody said, okay, how do you do this? How do you awaken? He says, well, you practice these four foundations of mindfulness. So this is pretty core. Now, mindfulness is, you know, entered the popular culture and lingo. So the kind of the popular definition of mindfulness, as most people are familiar with it, really comes from mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was a creation of Jon Kabat-Zinn and others, where, you know, really tried to take this practice and put it into a secular context, especially how it could be used in medical contexts and stuff like that. So it ended up being, you know, very very successful and obviously very beneficial thing. So for this is his definition of mindfulness. He says, mindfulness is awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. And then he says, I sometimes add, in the service of self-understanding and wisdom. So there's a sense that mindfulness is just, you know, kind of like dropping that judgment and just being aware of, you know, what is going on. Which that is certainly an aspect of Buddhist mindfulness. But within the Buddhist tradition, and I mean, he very deliberately like simplified and took, you know, this kind of this one sliver of what mindfulness means in the Buddhist tradition, and shared that and taught that. But within the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness is, you know, there's much more to it, and it's only one of many faculties that we bring to bear when we're practicing. So I'll introduce you to, so the Buddha mentions the four foundations of mindfulness many times in the Pali Canon, but the most famous place is in the Satipatthana Sutta, or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta, or the Four Establishings of Mindfulness. So I'm just going to read a little bit of it. And, you know, if you are somebody who doesn't really like, I don't know, old texts or, you know, intellectual lists or whatever, just bear with me. because I think it's useful. You know, these classes have two purposes. One is to, you know, give you tools for practice, but another is to expose you to the Buddhist tradition. So, you know, I think it's worthwhile for you to hear a little bit of the Pali Canon. So, thus have I heard. And just when you hear thus have I heard, you know this sutta is being recited by the Buddha's disciple Ananda. Supposedly, after the Buddha passed away, he had an eidetic memory and he was able to recite everything that the Buddha said. So this is Ananda reciting what he had heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasamadama. Then he addressed the monks. Thus, monks, venerable sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Monks, this is the one-way path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the passing away of pain and dejection, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely, the four establishments of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, monks, a monk dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating feelings in feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating mind in mind, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, having subdued longing and dejection in regard to the world. So this was a orally transmitted tradition for several hundred years before it was written down, thus, well, the repetition. So, so mindfulness of the body, feelings, mind, and then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is translated different ways. It's often said mind objects. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as phenomena. If you look at the list, which we will get to in the next class, of what it is you're supposed to be being mindful of, it's essentially the Dhamma teachings. It's the Dharma teachings. It's the Four Noble Truths. It's the Eightfold Path. It's impermanence. It's so essentially that fourth foundation of mindfulness is being mindful of like how the Dharma manifests in phenomena, seeing how, you know, dukkha arises and how dukkha ends. And so really observing the Dharma in action. So in terms of mindfulness, like what does mindfulness really mean? So the sati, so the Satipatthana is the sutta, and sati is mindfulness, patthana is establishing. So this is a meditative technique for training the mind to keep mindfulness firmly established in a particular frame of reference in all of its activities. And the term sati is related to the verb sarati, to remember or keep in mind. So to remember. So the analogy that I've come up with for this is that you're trying to find something in binoculars. And I don't know if you've ever, you know, tried to find like a bird in the binoculars. There are different things that go in to keeping, you know, to finding and keeping what you're looking at and really being able to see it through those binoculars. So you have, you know, first of all, your intention, your determination to do this whole thing. You have focus, you know, once you find something, there's a, you know, you want to like kind of focus in on it. You need, there's a certain part of you that needs to know where to look. You need to have some energy and determination to kind of keep your arms up and keep at the task. Now, mindfulness is the ability to remember what it is you're supposed to be looking at. So maybe you have those binoculars up and you're like, oh, what? Cool, what's that? Like, oh, right, I wanted to look at that. Mindfulness is this. And not just, I mean, the ability to bring those binoculars back to what you're supposed to be looking at and hopefully keep them there for a while. So that's the faculty. There's also concentration. Concentration is like the focusing of the binoculars, and, you know, the intention is staying on the task. But the mindfulness is being able to bring the awareness back and hopefully keep it there. Now, one of the things, and one of my favorite Buddhist scholars is Tanisiro Bhikkhu, and he is quite critical of the way that we use the term mindfulness in the modern dialogue, because it's kind of aimless, like it's an end unto itself. But he makes an argument, at least in the Buddhist context, there's right mindfulness. So in this case, it matters what you're paying attention to. I mean, yes, learning how to pay attention is a good thing, learning how to keep your, you know, bring your mind to something, but what are you looking at? It matters what's the focus of your mindfulness. So to use just another analogy, you know, if your mindfulness is about keeping your eye on the road so that you can get to where you're going, you know, it's not very good to become mindful of like that road over there, or overly mindful of some beautiful scenery as you drive along. You kind of need to be mindful of the road. So it isn't just mindfulness for its own sake. It's mindfulness for a purpose. And, you know, one of the things that's very clear about original Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, it has a purpose. In Zen, we talk a lot about like kind of no gaining idea and what is there to gain. And ultimately, we have a purpose too. We just go about it kind of indirectly so that we don't get you all, you know, excited about a gaining idea, but we have a purpose too. So the four establishings of mindfulness then are what you should be paying attention to. So it's not just mindfulness for its own sake. It's like, if you want to walk this path, if you want this liberation, said in the Satipatthana Sutta, the one-way path to end all, you know, suffering, these are what you should pay attention to. So the body, which we'll be talking about tonight, that's pretty obvious. Feelings in this context, which hopefully we may also get tonight, feelings are not complex emotions that we tend to refer to sometimes when we're talking about feelings. Feelings in a Buddhist context are like, dislike, and neutral. So they're kind of like feelings, they're very basic. And usually what we think of as emotions are like, you know, the like and the dislike are, you know, arose. And then, you know, there's all sorts of other complicated stuff attached. There's stories and ideas and stuff like that attached to that. These are very kind of very basic level feelings, like, dislike, neutral. And then they also kind of talks about difference between kind of a spiritual versus a kind of, can't remember what they call it, like a sensual, like, dislike. and then, like I said, phenomena or the Dharma is the fourth one. So this is, let's see. These are then the subjects of classical Buddhist meditation, which we'll start on. Now, our Zazen is very different than this. Our Zazen, so it's kind of hard to get your mind around, like, okay, so how can this be the same tradition? So here's how the Buddha taught meditation, and then we do something completely different. That's kind of what that second podcast I did was about, which is like, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into it tonight, but all of these aspects of study and reflection and contemplation are things that we do in our practice, just not necessarily in this systematic way and not necessarily on the meditation cushion. You know, in Zen, we kind of think of mindfulness as being something more that we do off the cushion. So I'll get to more of that later. But and also, because Zen has, you know, is built on the foundation of this older form of Buddhism, the way my teacher put it is sometimes it's time for Hinayana practice. So Hinayana means lesser vehicle. So we don't, that's not what we're talking about Theravadan Buddhism, but sometimes it's time to go back to this more, you know, there's a purpose, there's a goal, you're trying to achieve something. There's a time for this kind of practice, particularly perhaps when something really disturbing is coming up or your mind is getting stuck in certain kinds of loops. You know, sometimes it's time to like, all right, it's time for me to sit down and like get to the bottom of this and like work it out. So, you know, sometimes it's good to turn toward back these kind of more deliberate practices. One interesting feature of these instructions are they say contemplate the body in the body and contemplate the feelings in the feelings. Contemplate the mind, and these are mind states really, contemplate the mind in the mind and then the so far with the phenomena. So what, just going to throw that out there, what do you think that means? How would you contemplate the body in the body as opposed to, you know, I don't know, what, not doing that?
Direct sensory perception rather than kind of analyzing how your sensations feel. Developing a relationship with them instead of being consumed.
Instead of what?
Instead of being consumed by the feeling, developing a relationship with them.
Yeah, although that, I would say that that's like we become mindful of the feeling, but this kind of, why would you say the feel, why, you know, aware, it says contemplate the feeling in the feeling or the body in the body. And I think you're, you know, you're onto it there with like the, it's you know, it's difficult to get, this is experiential stuff that we're trying to describe in words, but
I can understand it from the, especially the body part, is like actually being present with the body, with whatever's happening in the body at that moment. But the thing that is harder for me to kind of think about is the feeling and the feeling, like, is that, because the feeling is like, I can feel the feeling in the body. What's going on when I'm having that feeling?
Yeah.
Like or dislike?
Yeah.
Or neutral?
Being in the body is kind of an appreciation of wherever that moment is at for me or takes me to. But being in the mind, that's a little bit different to me because thinking and feeling are two different things. But when my mind feels, you know, open, I guess that's possibly be there, because there's nothing to me kind of pressing or meaning of it. I'm just there.
Yeah. I guess maybe maybe we can explore some more of the difficult aspects of this when we get to like feelings and mind states, and what does that mean? You know, to contemplate the feeling in the feeling. But I think it probably is a little more straightforward for the body. I mean, it's a subtle thing. It's a subtle thing, but you know, I don't know if you've ever had a pain and then worked with it in terms, you know, of mindfulness. And there can be a sense of like, oh, I got a pain in my knee. And there's a, no, like there's a sense of separation from it. And you can kind of like, contemplate the knee. And then, I don't know, it's like there's this sense of, instead of like the, you know, aware of the pain and the pain or whatever, that it's, we're not separate from it. We're not trying to maintain distance from it.
Getting curious about it.
Yeah, and then it's different. The awareness is different. Or no.
A very non-dualistic way of relating to it is what it sounds like to me, or feels like. You are one with what you're. Well, in the body, you're at one with what your body is doing, and you're not conceptualizing about it. You're not one step removed thinking about it.
Maybe we could say it's like contemplating the body with the body. That kind of works for me. Like, so that, you know, you're aware of the hand with the hand, as opposed to, you know, being aware of the hand in the kind of intellectual way, aware of the hand with the hand. So each of the four areas is especially the body. And there's a sense that there's a progression through these practices that, you know, you would, if you're really doing these traditionally, you would spend a long time contemplating the body, a long time with mindfulness of the body. Then you would move on to mindfulness of these very simple feelings. Then you would move on to mind states like dullness and agitation and whatever. And then you would move on to mindfulness of the Dhamma. So the body part in particular is very, very long, very involved, and has four areas. And the first one is mindfulness of breathing, which I'll talk about each one. There's mindfulness of your postures, standing, sitting, lying down, and I think walking as well. Then there's a whole part that would be very interesting to discuss. Contemplating unattractiveness of the body, breaking down the body into elements, and charnel ground meditations. So we'll talk about that. And then, yeah, okay, actually that's all the body part. So delving into the mindfulness of, let's see, I pulled my bookmark out. I think it's two. There we go. I'm just going to read a little bit of mindfulness of the breathing so you get a sense. And how, monks, does a monk dwell contemplating the body in the body? Here a monk gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, straightened his body, and established mindfulness in front of him, just mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. or breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus. I will breathe in experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I will breathe in experiencing the whole, breathe out experiencing the whole body. I will breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formation. I will breathe out tranquilizing, I breathe out tranquilizing the bodily formation. So, you know, this is like a deeper and deeper absorption in the process of breathing. So that paying attention to the, you know, short breath, long breath, not trying to control it, but just noticing that. And this is definitely a concentration or directed effort kind of meditative practice, which is not what Shikantaza is, as I've talked about before, but obviously for many people it's a very effective form of mind training. And then he goes from contemplating the body, so then it's more general body awareness. So I just want to throw out here, do you ever practice mindfulness of breathing? I know that's the way that a lot of people are imitate, you know, in, initiate, whatever, like when they're introduced to Zazen, people mention that you can follow your breath, follow your exhalations, count your exhalations 1 to 10 or something like that. So, do you ever practice mindfulness of breathing either on or off the cushion? And when you do that, what happens in your body mind?
Watching your breath builds up or strengthens an ability to stay aware and focused, which then is a foundation for Shikantaza. And you can then let go of that effort to focus when you are just sitting. But without having developed that ability, it's all too easy with just sitting to be floating all over the place and not really present.
That's kind of how I use it. I usually will start in silence and breath, but try not to stay there.
I agree with that, with the cushion, but also off the cushion. If I'm going like too crazy, I take breath, or if I'm angry, because I model it for my kids, so. I do. We do it together, and actually, it like really, really helps, like both, for both, like upset to be able to like breathe, and it's like, oh, so calming, so much better. Just 5 breaths. Take that long.
So the immediate anchor back into actual present, right?
Yeah, right. Like
what's real and what's not real.
Yes.
Out of the story into the present.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes that we never want to be in pain, psychological or physical, but sometimes being in pain is a good motivator, because then like you have to keep coming back in order to stay sane, you know? Because if you don't come back, then it'll just be overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole, you know, underlying physiological aspect to the breathing with regards to like fight or flight and sympathetic and stuff like that, your nervous system. Mm. So you know, if you're in one of those states, go to breathing as a way to kind of engage the parasympathetic.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the reasons that in our chanting practice, it's recommended that you take as big and quick a breath as you can, and then you chant for as long as you possibly can before taking another big breath, and you chant for as long as you possibly can, because I hadn't really thought about this, but a Japanese nun was telling me about this, like that's that, you know, it sends the message to your body, it calms you down, because you aren't, you know, you're essentially slowing your breathing down a lot. And so who would have thought? For me, I find I don't really know why this is on the in the section on breathing, but another contemplation of the body. This is kind of what I do. I don't so much go to the breath, just, you know, over the course of the day, but this. In this way, he dwells contemplating the body and the body internally, or he dwells contemplating the body and the body externally, or both. Contemplating the body and the nature of its arising, or he dwells contemplating in the body of its nature of vanishing, or he dwells contemplating in the body its nature of both arising or vanishing, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. Just like that, there is a body. In a way, just, you know, coming back to embodiment, that sense that, like, all these terrible things that we know are happening and all these terrible things that we know could happen and right here, right now, we're okay.
I think also being aware of the breath brings you to the awareness of when you're not breathing.
Mm. And so then what, I mean, I guess I'll throw out here, what do you think it means, contemplating the body and its nature of its arising or vanishing? I don't know, maybe we'll get to that later when we're talking about the charnel ground. I don't know. I think that's later. I'm not sure at this section what it's talking about. Certainly the changing conditions of the body, perhaps, and the, you know, the breath is always moving. And he dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So in terms of the four postures, again, monks, when walking, a monk understands, I am walking. When standing, he understands, I am standing. When sitting, he understands, I am sitting. When lying down, he understands, I am lying down. He understands accordingly, however his body is disposed. And then it goes through the same bit about, like, contemplating kind of externally, internally, the arising and perishing of certain experiences. And then, just because this is related, the next section is on clear comprehension. So those are kind of, you know, you have this progression, like you get aware, I am sitting, I am lying down, I'm walking. Now you get aware of, act with clear comprehension when going forward and returning, looking ahead and looking away, when bending and stretching his limbs, who acts with clear comprehension when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing, and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent, So this is like all day practice. And to some extent, I mean, this is the kind of practice that, you know, modern mindfulness, you know, just becoming aware of what's going on in a, you know, just a non-judgmental way is aiming people toward, is this, just this awareness of the body, whatever it is that we are doing. Kind of at any moment we can just go, okay, now I'm sitting up. Why is that so? I mean, we don't have to really know why it's so powerful, but why is that so powerful? Why is that so effective to us?
Well, it keeps us present. I mean, when I'm doing Gesho, I'm fully present. And I know it doesn't matter if I can't do it or don't attempt or keep in. I'm totally present because that's what it takes for me to do those two things. And I mean, I find it joyful because there's nothing else on my screen.
Kind of like that childlike curiosity of seeing everything new.
What kind of, if you're willing to share, what kind of physical activities or positions or whatever through your day do you tend to become aware of, or perhaps try to cultivate awareness of?
Maybe during a yoga class.
Those moments when I'm in between things, when I'm waiting in line or somewhere, and that's a time when all that thinking is going to happen, and that's a time when it's good to put it to the present.
Little moment of mindfulness there, and the.
Well, I always am trying to get from I am breathing or I am walking to just breathing, just walking. That's the next step to lose the I, even that degree of separation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it sounds in this description like. Like there's a little of both involved there, you know, that there are times when he's saying, you know, he's like, I am standing, but then there's also the moments of contemplating the body with the body, you know. So there are always like some place deeper that we can take it.
I was given one of those jade rollers, you know, that's like supposed to be good for your face. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's kind of like a spa treatment or like something you can do at home. And I brought it to my desk at work, and I just like, I'll just sit back for like 5 minutes and just try it. And it's funny because it squeaks, so my coworkers know what I'm doing in the other cubicle. But it is, it's just like my moment of like, oh, I feel the cold stone on my face. You know, and I feel my muscles in my jaw, and it's kind of just become like my little like thing that I do at work, and it totally takes me out of everything for like a few seconds.
I hate washing dishes, like I hate it. So I've been trying to like enjoy, like appreciate it. So that now has been my. I'm so happy I have a plate, and I'm so happy I have running water, and I'm so happy I have warm water, and I have food on this plate. So I'm trying to like switch my hate, my dislike, to appreciation that I had food, I had a wonderful meal, I had to the things that I guess I do appreciate. I don't know if that's good. I mean, it's like and dislike is supposed to be like neutral. I'm trying to get it where I'm being appreciative of something, but that's helping me be in the present and feeling the water and enjoying that moment.
Yeah.
Like feeling the water on my hands, feeling, looking at the soap, like just have that, I'm in there in the moment. strings and whatever. It's helped. I mean, I still, mm-hmm. I see like a pile of dishes, it's like, ah. And I'm actually like, okay.
Take a breath. This is great. So I'm trying to find that
moment of enjoying and being present. Yeah. Other mindful moments. When I'm putting a meal together, I'm hungry and I like to cook, so I'm usually pretty mindful. Mm. And then I mess up, it's because my mind went somewhere else, even in a regular, routine.
I just sit in my hot tub where it had been, it's just really relaxing. It feels a body, and I just sit there and sort of feel like five things I'm grateful for that day, and just a nice in my body place.
Yeah. Basically, strangely enough, it's when one of the times is when I am having a bad feeling, a painful feeling, upset or sad or angry, and letting go of the story that goes along with that and being just present with the feeling and letting the feeling just be what it is. And moving towards it rather than away from it, and it sort of magically makes it better.
I don't think we're going to get to feelings tonight, but next week. Yeah.
Oftentimes, for me, when I get agitated, that's usually because when we've done something or not done something or done something correctly, and it helps a lot. Remember that that person is also busy and hairy and dealing with a lot of different things too. And rather than get upset at what they did, but relate to their experience and passion. I turn more and more to that. The longer I practice it, the more and more to that kind of behavior. And I used to, at the time, kind of like centering, you just sort of sit there and bring everything back down to kind of this point. I don't do that much anymore. It's more likely that I'll start thinking about the other person on their
view. Be mindful of yellow lights where you take your foot off the gas pedal and you put it on the brake instead of pushing the gas pedal. That's been a mindful practice since Christmas.
Instead of running down. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it?
It's a net. Oh, you got cameras now. So,
yeah. So that's a smart thing.
Why did you get a teenager
everywhere? I really have to be attentive to it.
For some reason, I find myself getting remembering to be mindful when I'm pushing my cart around Winco. You know, not the whole time, but for some reason, I don't know, when I'm pushing my cart around Winco grocery store.
You're right.
I don't know.
Same idea.
I don't know, you know, what it is, but at that point, I remember more often to like, I am just pushing my cart down the aisle and I'm aware of where other people are. And the other one is, just in terms of this kind of bringing us back to the body, it's definitely when my little dog Suka is on the bed and I turn her over on her back and I bury my face in her fur. You know, there's just like in that moment, there's just... It's just that. It's just being in the body. And very, very sweet. And I mean, thank goodness for these practices that, I mean, this is why mindfulness has ended up getting so popular. It's an incredibly powerful, powerful practice when we're being drawn up into our mind in a way that we know is either painful or not helpful. And you can't fight that. You know, you can't fight the mind with the mind. I mean, you try, but it just gets in a long argument with itself. You just have to, like, you know, do something different. So very briefly, so next time we can start with feelings. We'll do just kind of an overview of feelings and mind states. And I don't think we really need to talk a lot about mindfulness of the Dharma, because, I mean, that's essentially what we do through study. But I'll say a little bit about all this, like, contemplating the unattractiveness of the body and breaking it down into its elements and the charnel ground meditations, which, you know, in the Buddhist time, they didn't just whisk bodies away, you know, didn't embalm them, make them look pretty, keep them in a freezer, and then whisk them away. You know, out they went, and you go to the burning ghats and you watch them burn, or there's some of them you left to rot, or it was a tradition of a particular sect in India that just, you know, put them out for the birds. So, you know, it was a tradition of monks to go meditate there. So I just want to throw open, like, okay, these seem like pretty extreme practices. Why do you think they were recommended? And, you know, why do you think they could possibly be good or have something to teach us?
Contemplate impermanence.
I mean, there's
how you make, you know, the ecosystem. If your birds are there, and you say that would be food for the birds. Just knowing that we're all connected. I don't know if that's Buddhist or not, but I mean,
contemplating the unattractiveness of the body. You basically sit and you contemplate that you're composed of, like, pus and mucus and blood and, like, you know, sweat and all this kind of stuff. Stuff that I'm imagining if you were a nurse, you'd have a really easy time calling up these things. And there's nothing. There is nothing we are more attached to than our body. Whether we are vain or not, there's nothing. I mean, that is like, that's pretty basic. Like, without this, I wouldn't exist. Like that, you know, it's my source of pain. It's my source of joy. It's my source of sustenance. This is, yeah.
My doctor has given me some exercises to do because I've been having some vertigo, and it's crystals. And so he says, do this, kind of an exercise, and it does help if you feel it coming on. It's meditative. The room going around.
But the whole point, you know, is that self-attachment leads to suffering. So it's not about somehow, you know, getting us to not want to be alive or something like that, to hate life or, I don't know, hate our bodies or something like that. I'm just guessing, like, the monks didn't really have that problem. I think this is probably more of a modern thing, you know, that this would probably not be the wisest kind of practices for many people to do, but that that sense of breaking ourselves, you know, to see ourselves in that kind of organic way, and then, you know, as we age and things change and fall apart, and to become mindful of that in that way, like almost like, you know, use Jon Kabat-Zinn's approach of, like, of non-judgmental, of non-reactive, to just look at it, to just see it for what it is. Drop the stories, good and bad, can I mean, the idea is that it leads to liberation. It actually leads to a less attachment to our body or to our vanity or to our abilities or...
There's really something to that.
Mm-hmm.
I just went through this period in my life where I took a lot of funerals. I was going to go to another one on Sunday, or Saturday. And some of them had the person there, and some of them were these, what's popular now, where you have these gatherings that are in public spaces, like in restaurants, and there's maybe a slideshow of the person, but there's very little connection to that person anymore.
Huh. Interesting.
I've been through Saturday Night Live of these recently. It's like I'm starting to get a little critical.
I'll tell you, I'll give you like a funeral review critic. Yeah.
There's something weird, I'm speaking from my own personal experience, about trying to grieve in a public space. I just don't think it works very well. So I was thinking about what you were saying about sky burials and really become familiar with what happens to your body when they die. And I think there's something really, there's a lot of lessons in that I think we have just completely divorced ourselves from in this culture. And I don't think it's really healthy. It's, I've been thinking a lot about that.
It's interesting. The tradition that we have in our lineage, which is, I haven't really communicated much to our Sangha, but is a possibility for people to request that when they die, I mean, assuming the family goes along with it, that's a big one, but that when we die, if we want to, we can have Sangha members come and wash our body. They wash our body, and you know, and if you're a man, you like get a shave, wash our body, dress us in a white kimono, which is the color of death in the Japanese culture, and they give you a mala and a white raka suit, and then everybody comes and visits and pays their respect and sits there and cries and contemplates and absorbs. And ideally that goes on for, you know, the better part of a day. There's, you know, so anybody, you know, come on. Everybody, go, you know, come visit, come witness. Yeah.
In many cultures, it's an honoring of a way of leaving, of detaching.
Yeah.
It's an honoring, and you know, I know there are people in our Sangha who've also done hospice just to sit with people in their last days or to watch them struggle with breath or to do their, to let them lead your breath. It's very beautiful.
So, in that way, it's almost like you could. You know, I hadn't really thought about it this way before, but like actually sitting in the charnel ground, not even so much maybe to be like, oh, I don't care about this body now because I've seen how impermanent everything is, but almost more like, I mean, like you were saying, like, it's okay. You know, that actually somehow getting more familiar with that process could actually make us feel like it's okay.
I think we pushed away the concept of mortality. I'm sure they did that even way back then, too.
Yeah, I imagine it was only the monks hanging out in the charnel grounds, probably.
They were much closer, more familiar with death, especially if you're cleaning the body and robing it and such. I mean, the only experience in my life, although a lot of people are not away, one of the members of my community died. He had a battle with cancer, and he chose the hospice at home and passed away at home. And we left it there for the day, and we all gathered in his apartment that evening. And the kids, the dog, and the saints, and such. It was actually an incredible experience.
Mm-hmm.
He very much embraced, and appropriate for him too, very much. He had two funerals before he was dead. He participated. For his many friends, and then he had another funeral for his closer friend, because he was still there.
Yeah, how they don't hear, we don't hear the appreciations that people have for us. Mm-hmm. So I've done hospice with persons having their last days with the memorial service or a memory service, with them sitting in their wheelchair in the middle of the room.
Sweet, sweet.
And it's been awesome. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, thank you for a very, very fascinating discussion.
Very, thank you.